can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, hello out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that often lift and almost always separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, we're glad to have you here. Believe it or not, this is episode one of season six. Season six, that's a lot of podcast episodes.
That is. We feel good about it.
We do.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you are coming back to see us again, then, well, you know why you're here. You're ready for some more of our usual movie nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what David and I like to do is get together once a week and talk movies, and we decided to make a show out of it. He leans toward the sci-fi end. I lean toward the horror end. And we like to dissect these films and see what makes them special to us. Mm-hmm. And maybe to you as well. As I mentioned, I'm with my good friend, David Horton, and co-host, that is. David, how are you doing this wonderful morning?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to start a new season. And welcome back, everybody who's been patiently waiting over the summer for us to come back. This is brand new and fresh, and we're tackling a huge, literally ginormous film today. So yeah. I'm excited about that. Normally, we start with like genre week and what have we been doing. And I don't want to talk about the whole hiatus and what I'm doing. But one thing I did do and I wanted to talk about was I revisited all of the animated series of Star Trek. So we're doing, our sister podcast, we're doing the original series, TOS, as they say, which led me immediately to TAS, which is the animated series. And we've talked about it a little. I've brought it up before and talked about it, but I went ahead and did a full rewatch of all of them and then did some jumping into, who wrote them, who did them, all of that kind of stuff. It's very interesting that a lot of them considered it like the fourth season kind of thing of Star Trek. And except for the fact that the animation is so cheap and you can also hear James Doohan do about 75 freaking voices every episode, I really like some of the storytelling in it.
And there's two seasons?
Yeah, there's two seasons.
I was wondering, because you said it was officially or unofficially the fourth season of Star Trek, it would technically be the fourth and fifth season, unless you're talking the same amount of episodes, which then in that case, it would be just one season.
Right, essentially. And it's weird. Like I said, yes, there are 22 total episodes.
Okay.
But they only showed, like, the first season only has like 10 episodes, and then they repeated them again, and plus two of them an additional time to make it a 22 season run.
How would you rank it?
Some of them, story-wise, would have equaled the original series, okay. I think. Some of their stories were really really compelling, really interesting. Some of them were silly. They did a Gulliver's Travel episode, which ironically was written by Paul Schrader, the same guy that did Balance of Terror, that we both really, really loved when we reviewed the first season. But he did this one called the Territon Incident, where they shrink. And it's like little bitty running around the bridge and trying to, all three of them trying to open up a communicator. And it's very gullible. God. It was very silly.
It's Richard Matheson.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was for, it was for kids television Saturday morning.
Right.
But some of the stuff, the maturity level and I was going, this is not a cartoon for kids. They're talking about everybody on the planet will die, Jim, and all this stuff. And I'm going, wow. All right. And then I could turn over and watch Sigmund and the Sea Monsters or whatever, or, Land of the Lost.
He mated with a Gorn, Jim. They're having a lizard baby.
A lizard baby. yeah. So anyway, that's what I've been doing. I caught up on all of those. And next time I'll tell you what else I've been doing on the hiatus sort of thing.
Yeah. What's the hiatus of ours over the summer? I was like, what hiatus? Correct. Is there a writer's strike? I didn't know what was going on.
Well, we've been all hiatus-y. Yeah.
Well, guess where I was?
Where was you?
I was down the hallways of Shudder.
That's terrifying.
I happened to catch this lovely little gem, Terror Train.
Oh, my gosh. From like, what was that from? Like 80, 81?
1980.
Yeah.
Starring Jamie Lee Curtis, who was by then known as the Scream Queen. Mm-hmm. I found out the reason for that is because between 1978 and 1980, she did four horror movies. She did Halloween, The Fog, Prom Night, and Terror Train.
Mm-hmm.
This one was a little Canadian gem. And I have to say, it is not a great movie, but it is well worth watching, very much for similar reasons as The Devil's Reign, because there's a lot going on in this movie with the cast and stuff.
Okay.
It was directed by Roger Spottiswoode, who was not a really well-known director, but he happened to be friends with Ben Johnson.
Okay.
Ben Johnson, old Western actor, used to be in all the John Ford, John Wayne movies.
Oh, yeah.
And he won an Oscar. He was an Oscar winner for Last Picture Show. The Peter, what's his name? Who's the director of that? I can't remember.
Bogdanovich.
Peter Bogdanovich. Yes, exactly. This movie not only stars an Oscar winner, it is not only a cheap Canadian movie, it stars Jamie Lee Curtis, who I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It stars Hart Bochner, who you might recognize.
Yeah, that name is fairly familiar. Yeah.
He was the sleazeball office dude in Die Hard.
Okay.
I mean, yep. I pictured him immediately as soon as I saw him.
Oh, yeah.
It stars David Copperfield.
In Terror Train?
Yes.
Are we talking about the same movie?
There's yes. No way. He is a magician in the movie as well.
Well, okay then.
And he's a terrible actor, and he looks exactly like Dan Carey did when we were in high school. not kidding. I was like, is Dan Carey in this movie? This is crazy.
Look at him. Okay.
It also stars Derek McKinnon, who was basically taking his friend to the audition, and he got cast instead. And he was a drag queen.
Okay.
So he was a Canadian drag queen that performed locally, accidentally got cast as the lead in this movie. He is the killer.
Spoiler. Now I can't watch it.
Well, no, I mean, it's very obvious. But I mean, it's kind of done like a mystery because he changes costumes with each murder. But it's set up in the beginning. You know that this guy's going to end up being the killer. So
okay.
And then lastly, it stars Vanity.
Okay, then.
From Vanity 6.
Vanity 6?
I guess you'd call it a Prince and the Revolution offshoot band of the 80s. Vanity has a part in this movie as well. Basically, the synopsis is a college fraternity prank goes wrong. The student ends up in a mental asylum. 3 years later, it's graduation, and the members of the fraternity decide to have a costume party aboard a moving train to celebrate their graduation. Nothing. Unknown to them, the killer, of course, slips aboard and starts killing them off one by one. Mm-hmm. Would I recommend this movie? Well, it scores 44% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would recommend it because it is a classic slasher film. It stars a classic Scream Queen, and even though it's cheesy and pretty bad, it's got a great cast. And I would recommend it.
I remember watching it when it came out. I've seen this movie, and I saw Prom Night as well. And when you first mentioned it, and I first saw your graphic there, I had a story, but I cannot remember now if it was Terror Train or Prom Night. But it was one or the other, but a big memory I have from it is, and maybe you can tell me since you just watched the movie,
mm-hmm.
is the killer at one point has Jamie Lee down, like strangling her, almost, trying to kill her.
okay,
kind of thing. And it's the close up of her and she's struggling and everything else. And he reaches a finger up and puts it in her hoop earring.
Yes.
And rips it out.
It's this.
Okay. I always remember that because A, when it happened, I thought, ow, you know how I am about any kind of, you know, physical, you know, pain or cuts or any kind of that kind of stuff. But also the fact that I had thought, you know, that would be a good torture thing to do. That's a thing. That's a great thing for a mad killer, you know, torture person to do.
Yeah.
Is rip your earrings out of their ears. That would just hurt.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, it was that. See, so I did remember this movie. I know all about it now.
Yeah. Well, another reason I would recommend it is it was kind of ahead of its time because not only did it cast a real drag queen in it, he actually becomes the magician's assistant at one point. So he is okay. in drag and murders somebody. And I was like, and this was also around the time that I think Dress to Kill came out. I can't remember what year that was.
I think Dress to Kill was 81.
Okay, very close. So Brian De Palma was doing something similarly the very next year.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, I looked up, while you were doing your description, I was looking up Spottiswood because I knew that name. And he did a bunch of movies in the 80s and 90s. I mean, Pursuit of B.D. Cooper, Shoot to Kill. He did that Schwarzenegger one, The Sixth Day. I remember that's how I remembered him because it was science fiction.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, he was friends with Ben Johnson, and Ben Johnson agreed to do this movie without reading the script because he was such good friends with him. They also like rebuilt real train cars to film in. They had to make them larger to fit the equipment in and stuff. Like I said, it's not a great movie, but it is highly worth watching just for, I don't know, just little interesting things like that.
Okay.
So,
all right. Well, the movie we're talking today has some rebuilding and some building giant things to
building blocks,
building and the building blocks of life. Yes. For those of you who have no idea and just stumbled upon us, we are going to go back to a literal blockbuster classic, huge film that came out in 1993. And as one of my podcast guys I listen to all the time says, this is one of the movies that ruined Hollywood forever, sort of thing. It changed the way movies were made forever.
I don't agree with that.
Well, I mean, he says it, you know, that's a tongue-in-cheek way of him saying it. What he means are revolutionary movies that changed the way filmmaking was done. Star Wars is a good example. You know, Citizen Kane, for that matter, is a great example. sure. Sure. This movie came out in 1993. It was directed by the master, the maestro, the incredible Steven Spielberg. It's called Jurassic Park. A brief synopsis, just since, you know, we're not spoiling anything because you guys should have seen this by now. And
it's only been 30 years. It is the 30th anniversary, by the way. You do realize that.
See, there you go, 30th anniversary. And if we get to the end of this podcast and you don't say it's on the 1001, we're going to have an issue, I think. But anyway, the basic story premise, we follow two paleontologists who are taken on a trip to a private island that a huge multi-gajillionaire owns, and he has created an amusement park for everyone based on dinosaur DNA, and he's basically recreated dinosaurs, living, breathing, attacking, killing, and slashing dinosaurs in this zoo-type theme park, amusement park. He is trying to validate its existence, or actually rather his insurance company and the lawyers are trying to validate the expense and the existence by bringing in two experts, the paleontologist.
And a paleobotanist.
paleo and a paleobotanist, yes. A paleontologist, a paleobotanist, and a mathematician whose forte is chaos theory. As they get to the island and go on a brief demonstration excursion, that little do they know there is an evil, not evil, I wouldn't call him evil at all. I would call him just a bad guy, who is trying to participate in a bit of corporate espionage and steal the samples of DNA for a rival company, unknown to us, who is trying to do the same thing and recreate dinosaurs as well. But he ends up messing up the entire park, causing everybody to be in great danger, and also, unfortunately, ends up being killed himself. But at the end, in the end, you know, everyone triumphs, so to speak. Did you see this movie when it came out?
I saw this movie probably the day it came out. If not, definitely the first week. I'm a huge fan. I was a huge fan of the book prior. I read the book before the movie.
I did too.
I actually, upon this viewing, and it's been a long time since I've seen this movie, I actually feel differently about some things I used to judge it for.
Okay.
I still think the book is a much better story. And I actually reread the book before I watched it again this time. So I've read the book three times. I've seen the movie probably 10 times. I used to say that, you know, the book's always better than the movie, blah, blah, blah. And in this case, it is. But Steven Spielberg is the one director that changed that rule for me with Jaws, because I think Jaws is a better movie than the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Upon rereading this and watching this movie, I'm really pleased with the screenplay, because they managed to capture so much in this that I understand why they had to take parts of it out.
Oh, yeah.
That being said, I also hated the kids, thinking that that was a Spielberg thing, but it's not. Hell, those kids are in the book, too, and that girl is even more annoying in the book than she is in the movie. So Spielberg toned them down a bit.
There's an age flip in the book. She's the younger one.
Is she? Okay. Well, she's the most annoying in the book. And she's probably the most annoying in the movie. But Spielberg, you know, I used to get mad at Spielberg because all his movies started centering around kids. And now I realize that, you know what? So did the book. So this is not necessarily his fault. And he did tone it down. So I have more respect for this movie upon this viewing. I have more respect for this movie.
Well, that's interesting. And I think a major key to the, you know, as we always point out keys, a major key to this movie is the book and the differences and the changes that came from it. I remember reading it, and the whole opening is the Compy attack, which is, you know, Compies aren't even in the movie sort of thing, which was, I think, a smart cut. You don't want too many dinosaurs. You can explore that in the book a little bit, but you can't really in the movie and invest a lot of time into it. But he substituted that great opening with trying to get the velociraptor in the cage, in the pit. Which is just as exciting and dynamic and scary and everything. It sets
and
the tone.
A hook. Yeah. Yeah.
Great hook, sets the tone for the whole movie. So well filmed, so well shot. Yeah, I agree with you. I think this is another example of Spielberg where the screenplay is actually better than the book. Even though the book may have more layers, more stuff to it, everything, this one is just better, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I would also go as far as to say, and I would probably say this in summation as well, that this is an iconic movie. That there are parts of this movie that are just legendary and should be included on reels like at the Oscars or what have you. I mean, the centerpiece alone, the T-Rex attack, is phenomenal. And then there's like another one a little later in the movie where they have the velociraptor attack in the kitchen. Both those scenes are just dynamic. They're like the psycho shower scene, you know?
Oh, yeah.
They're unforgettable.
Unforgettable. They are incredible. Yes. And those are both in my list of scenes, favorite scenes.
I didn't mean to segue, but I guess I already did.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. We can talk about, that's what I love about making this unscripted. We can talk about whatever, whenever. But those two scenes, yes. And I agree with you. They should be heralded in cinema history the same way, You know, you used to show Marlon Brando go, Stella, you know, in all the old retrospectives and stuff. Or I'm ready for my close up, Mr. DeMille.
Or the curtain going back in Psycho. Yeah.
Yeah. This is iconic filmmaking. And to me, doing the research on this, of course, I did a lot of research on Spielberg because he is my favorite. And the ability to do what he did this year, this one year in 93, I think is unprecedented and astounding.
It was so much he took 4 years off afterwards.
Yeah, I don't even think everyone's favorite Mr. Cameron could attempt something like this. I mean, he did Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in the same year.
Back to back.
Two incredibly, incredibly complex and emotional movies with visionary direction in each of them, and he did them back to back. Literally, he was on the set at Krakow filming Schindler's List. When he finished shooting for the day, he would go to the trailer or the studio or wherever in Poland and keep editing and doing final edits for Jurassic Park.
Right.
Every day.
Yeah. And when he said he was so sick of editing Jurassic Park that he thought it was horrible.
Yeah.
And yeah. I feel that way whenever I write a book. I'm like, oh God, this sucks. I've done too much.
Well, there's some great documentaries you guys can look at on YouTube or get the Blu-rays and the DVDs and find out about some of the stuff put together in this. But I do want to cover, if we could, let's throw out trivia, production, stuff like that we've talked about. But we haven't covered one. Sorry. You saw it opening day.
I don't know if I saw it opening week. It was very early. I know that.
I don't know if I saw it opening day or opening week, but I do remember seeing it on the front row of the theater. And I was literally, especially during the, it was, so I went back the next day and sat like midway back so I could absorb the whole movie because, man, it's massive. I also remember, I have another fond viewing memory of this movie of, I saw this at the Woodso Drive-In in Newport. And seeing this T-Rex on a giant screen, at a drive-in when the sun is still setting in the background was awesome.
I'm sure.
It was really cool.
This is also one of those movies. I know I say this often, and it's not really true about a lot of movies, but I have seen this movie several times in the theater, too.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be on a big screen.
I mean, it taps into that primordial, I think, thing. You know, my kids when they were growing up, my nephews and everything else now are, they love dinosaurs. They're kids and they love dinosaurs. I remember loving dinosaurs when I was a kid. And it was interesting on one of the documentaries, I found out that Spielberg's first toy he ever remembers receiving was a dinosaur.
It was a Stegosaurus, dinosaur. I think. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. You're right. And he said that he wanted to direct the dinosaur movie from when he was a little kid. And I think a lot of that has to do with his love of old films, too, of the, King Kong and, all of that, which is a huge key for me. This King Kong is a big key.
Well, and giving away another key, when I was a little kid, one of my favorite movies was The Land That Time Forgot, and it's a dinosaur movie. So,
yeah. Dinosaurs. And that was Ray Harryhausen, stop motion, all that. But I even remember some of those older, 50s movies where they would, take the lizard and, strap a fin on its back and have it crawl around on the set.
Yeah. It was terrible. And I don't think Harryhausen did Land of Time Forgot. I haven't looked, but because it's not that good.
Okay.
His would be better.
Dinosaurs have always been, I think, a part of this whole of our mythos, as human beings, being able to dig up their bones and see them in museums and everything else. Dinosaurs, and I remember I was just like Spielberg in an interview. I mean, he said when he was young, he actually thought about being a paleontologist, and so did I. Mm-hmm. I loved dinosaurs that much, wanted to be that. So,
I mean, I don't that or like an archaeologist or for sure.
I never wanted to be an archaeologist until I saw Indiana. So, so backstory or some stuff production-wise.
Sure.
Creature Designs, Stan Winston and his studio. Originally, that was going to be a combination of Stan Winston and Stop Animation with Phil Tippett. Phil Tippett is known for Star Wars and, you know, the Tauntauns and the AT-ATs and a lot of the stop animation that you see in Star Wars was Phil Tippett. He also had come off a movie Dragon Slayer, I think was Phil Tippett as well. With a new effect that he had come up with called Go Motion, which was a stop animation that also took anatomy into concern. So things jiggled, you know, almost like those lizards with the fins strapped to their backs kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's when they went into pre-production. That's what they were going to do. It was going to be a combination of stop animation for the dinosaurs and live action puppets that would be extremely tailored to do what Spielberg wanted or what he envisioned. I think he had learned a lot of puppetry, you know, especially after E.T., about how to use puppets and how to use them convincingly.
Did you do the research on like all the various directors that were connected to it?
No, but go with that. Let's do pre-production before we get into that. That'd
sure.
be great.
Spielberg was not the original first choice. The book was, of course, circulated before it was even published because they knew the book was going to be a huge hit. Mm-hmm. And at one point, Tim Burton was attached. I'm like, I don't see that at all.
I don't see that at all.
Richard Donner, who we've covered, he did Superman and Lethal Weapon. He was attached. Joe Dante was attached. We covered Explorers last year. Can't see it. Don't want rubber suit dinosaurs.
No.
And then finally, Crichton was reluctant to submit to a bidding war and just basically told his agent that put a set price on it because he felt that would guarantee it get made. Because you know how things get optioned and then not made. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And then Spielberg snatched it when that happened. So, and Spielberg was his first choice. They actually knew each other. Did you read about that?
Yeah, I saw that in one of the documentaries they mentioned.
Yeah,
that.
Spielberg was like a tour guide on the Universal backlot, and he gave Michael Crichton a tour when they were doing the Andromeda Strain. That was his first movie, which we've also covered on our first podcast, our first season.
Yes.
But that's all I had really about the directors. Did you mention that David Koepp was also a writer on it?
Okay. And I am not sure of that pronunciation, if it's Kep, Cop, or Cope.
So I don't really know
if anybody
either.
Out there listening knows, let us know what David's real name is, because he's a big script fixer.
So. He is, and I don't really know that much about him, but I did put in my notes that he did Stir of Echoes and Secret Window. One is Richard Matheson, and one is Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was kind of cool. But two other people, before I let you continue, that are just as equally important to this film as Michael Crichton and Steven Spielberg are John Williams and Dean Cundey. John Williams did the music. This music is always in my head. I'll never forget it. And
never.
Dean Cundey was John Carpenter's wonderful cinematographer, and of course he went on to bigger and better things, including this. So
I'm glad you mentioned both, because they are reasons definitely for the success of this film.
Mm-hmm.
This was also, I think, the only time I know it was the first, I can't necessarily say it's the only, but the first time that Spielberg was not with John Williams in the studio recording the live tracks. Every movie he has ever done with John, he's been there when they're recording.
Because
and he
of
couldn't
Schindler's
be because
List.
He was shooting Schindler's
List. Yeah.
Basically, he shot and filmed and began preliminary edit of Jurassic. Then he flew to Poland immediately. So that's why he was doing this dual effort of editing, final edits, color correction, audio editing, everything had to go into the final prep, music, all of that being added to while he was shooting principal photography of Schindler's. Then Jurassic got released. He started the edit process of Schindler's and released it in the fall. And it ended up becoming ended up, but at the end of that year, he had the top grossing movie and the Academy Award winning movie for Best Picture in the same year.
It's crazy.
And kind of, in case people didn't realize that he's probably, well, and I've gone on record as saying, I think Steven Spielberg is the best cinematic storyteller ever. I think his oeuvre is the best storytelling ever.
I do think it's funny that around the same time is when James Cameron emerged as being like number two as far as movies. Because Titanic came out shortly after this, and then all of a sudden it was like either Spielberg or Cameron had the highest grossing movie of all time forever and ever. Amen.
Well, and think of that parallel too. You had Terminator, which used stop animation. Mm-hmm. For the Terminator, you had this, which was going to use stop animation. This did CGI first, which we're getting to in a minute, but created this whole CGI, you know, thrust thing that it could be done. And then he does Terminator 2, mm-hmm. which is CGI.
And that was kind of a lead in for Spielberg for this, as far mm-hmm. as the development of CGI. We talk about those landmark films, and this is obviously one of them as far as CGI, but so was Terminator 2. So it was like a stair step.
Yeah, it's in several documentaries and the backstories and everything else, but part of what – to help with this process, because Spielberg knew that this was all back-to-back and all this kind of stuff, he actually had maquettes made, little models of the T-Rex and the dinosaurs and different things. He had miniature models made of the Jeeps and things like that. And he would take a little camera and a little camera lens and shoot the shots he wanted to shoot. And almost essentially creating animatics, which later became a big deal with Star Wars and the Star and George Lucas and James Cameron. And since then, it's kind of standard industry now.
Superhero movies. Yeah.
In the past, it was all storyboards. You would have storyboards, and sometimes you would take them and flash them with pictures just to kind of show a movement or something. You'll zoom in on the storyboard to say, this is the camera moving, all of that. But this was different. He literally took these little and made little scenes and little movies of these action sequences. And he was working at that time with Dennis Muren. Dennis Muren was with ILM. They had worked together on several other movies. Dennis Muren had worked, of course, with George Lucas and everything else. And Muren said, well, hey, why don't I just animate in some dinosaurs, you know, to help you? So it's not only just seeing and we know the dinosaurs in the background of the shot, Steven. I'll just put a dinosaur in there with computer animation.
Wow.
Really? And really flat and everything else, but still there just so you get the image. But as he was developing it, he suddenly realized, you know, this is actually looking pretty good. I could end up making this look pretty interesting. And so he developed like a 3-minute reel of showing a dinosaur walking. I think the first one was, it wasn't the Brontosaurus.
It's probably a T-Rex.
It might have been the T-Rex. Yes, I think it was the T-Rex. But he did the wireframe first. Then he did the musculature. Then he did all the coloration. He put that on a background plate of like a, you know, a canyon kind of thing. It was only like a 1-minute clip, something like that, I think I read. I don't see it in my notes, but showed it to Spielberg, showed it to everybody, the entire production team. Even Phil Tippett was there, who was the stop animation guy. And Steven at one point said, you know, Phil, what do you think? And he goes, I think I just became extinct.
Exactly.
Steven liked the line so much, he had put it in the screenplay, because that's what Malcolm says.
We're out of a job. Don't you mean extinct?
I can't imagine us having a conversation about this movie today if it had been stop animated, because I think it would have looked like shit.
It would not have had the effect.
No.
I think
it would have looked like one of those Nightmare on Elm Street movies where Freddy becomes a snake or something. You know, it would have been terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Spielberg probably could have done it effectively the way he did it. I mean, he definitely learned from Jaws. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, a huge key for me in this movie is Jaws too, just because of the hook at the beginning where a character gets killed and then we go to silence.
And
then
it's
we suddenly
beast.
Continue with the story.
Yeah, it's monsters.
The beast.
Yeah.
Don't show the monster until halfway through, sort of thing. Because we all want to see that. Again, one of my favorite lines is after the second time they don't see a dinosaur in the pen, and Malcolm gets right up in the camera going, hey, your dinosaur tour is going to have dinosaurs, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he really annoyed me back when this movie came out, and now he's one of my favorite things, very much like Hooper in Jaws.
Yeah.
Malcolm, yeah, that so, is, the Jeff Goldblum character. Yeah.
And Phil Tippett took that snippet of the CGI. He took it back to the guys, all the guys at his team that they were working on. All, he had already built the models and were already starting preliminary stop animation and everything else. He showed them the clip and said, ask what they think. And one of his guys even said, well, we're here at work and suddenly we're the dinosaur all of a sudden. Yeah.
So. I do think it's admirable that Spielberg kept him on as like a consultant, and in I think he actually still animated some stuff for like storyboarding purposes or something.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. He was hired on to animate now these animatics and actually create the full animation in the background for them. And he was there for all of the initial consulting stuff. There's some great stuff you can find on YouTube of just early planning sessions where they've got like a little whiteboard model of the Jeep, and Spielberg is talking about how, you know, and the T-Rex pushes down here and da 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 da, and Tippett is in the background telling Dennis Muren and the rest of the computer guys how the Tyrannosaurus should react and how it should move with its head, and he's doing all this kind of stuff because he knew the animals so well. One of the reasons that he was so good as a stop motion animator was he could create these realistic movements of the animals, and to keep him along to do that was a great idea. Mm-hmm. That was brilliant.
I found out a little bit more that I didn't know that I thought was kind of interesting, and it has to deal with Steven Spielberg's friendship with Michael Crichton. Mm-hmm. First of all, I already said that the book was, they knew it was going to be a hit, and Spielberg wanted to do it. However, he was encouraged. Michael Crichton's process is he comes up with an idea, and then he has lots of friends that either work in the medical field or science or somewhere, and he throws it at them to see how plausible it is or what they mm-hmm. think about it. And then if they like it, he starts going with it. I say that like he's still alive. Michael Crichton is no longer with us. But anyway, that was his writing process. And Crichton told Spielberg the idea, and Spielberg loved it so much that Spielberg actually coaxed a lot of the story out of him, including scenes he wanted in the movie. But you know that T-Rex scene was one that Spielberg probably came up with. When they were going to work, or right shortly before they were going to work on it, Spielberg was in the pre-production stages for a movie called ER, based on a Crichton novel. I've never heard of this novel. I think that's wrong. I don't know where I got that note, but I don't believe that. Anyway, when he heard about the Jurassic Park book, so he subsequently dumped ER to do this movie and became a producer of it on television. And that's where ER came from. The George Clooney, Juliana Margulies show was a Steven Spielberg and Michael Crichton production, but it was done for television instead because of Jurassic Park.
I remember seeing that on the credits and going, there is nothing Spielberg about this at frickin' all. This is all Michael Crichton.
Yeah, that was probably his gift back to him for being able to do Jurassic Park.
Great.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah.
I love the fact that this movie, screenplay-wise, we're talking about that, you know, pokes fun at itself. It pokes fun at Universal, which was the producer of it, and had this Universal tour that had been going for years and all of this.
When they opened Disneyland in 1956, nothing worked.
But John, if the Pirates of the Caribbean breaks down, the pirates don't eat the tourists.
And it feels like that. The whole Jeeps being done is like the trolley ride it used to be at Universal. And, you know, the one shot where they just show the merchandise, it's that entire wall of just lunchboxes and stuffed animals and, you know, koozies and all that.
Yeah, Disney did that first, though. That's more of a Disney thing.
Well, yeah, but that's what I mean.
He's making fun of amusement parks.
Making fun of that, of amusement parks in general.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Agreed with that.
So I know we've already mentioned two of the primary scenes. That was my spoiler, but
I have three that are really mine.
Okay.
Four total scenes that I love. I love the opening, of course. And I tend to like most of the movies that we really like. I'll tend to always say I like the opening because that to me is the hook,
yeah.
As we've talked about. We've mentioned the T-Rex scene. We've mentioned the Velociraptor scene. My other one is totally different than that. It's not an action piece or everything else. It's the first dino appearance. It's them leaving the helipad in the Jeeps and coming around and just the way he shoots Grant taking his hat off and standing up and then turning and seeing, and she's fascinated with the leaf, and he takes her head physically and turns it.
Yeah.
And the way the majesty and that music and it's really cool. There's one documentary you can watch where they show like the beginning of that scene and everything else. And when we first see the huge, you know, brachiosaur, you know, stand up on its hind legs and then bound and all that. But they show that whole scene, but they show it with all the sound effects and everything else, but no music. And then they show it with John Williams' music. And you just go, yes.
Oh, yeah.
There's, I can't picture it without it.
No.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
That swell and the way it looks and the fact that Grant almost faints, you know, and he has to sit down.
He's walking and his legs won't support him. They're like wobbling. Yeah. It's hilarious.
And then Hammond, just that pride and that whole happiness that he has. And he says the line of the movie.
Which was his favorite line of all the marketing. Yeah.
Yeah. What about you? So any other scenes other than those?
The whole movie pretty much, but if I had to pick a couple of other ones, I would say the Dennis Nedry scene with the Dilophosaur in the rain when he gets killed because I just hate him so much. I'll get to him in casting. And then also the scene at the end, which I found out by researching this time around how that came about. When the velociraptors get loose, one gets, I guess, loose from lets the other one out from the freezer or whatever, and they corner them in the lobby. And all of a sudden, the Tyrannosaur becomes the hero and sweeps in and attacks the velociraptor. Now, it's a bit of a... There's some logic issues there because he comes in quite stealthily. You don't hear him at all.
Yeah, but where were all those booming, vibrating footsteps?
Yeah. Exactly. But I do love that he turned the T-Rex into the hero, and he knew that the audience was going to want to see the T-Rex again. The original ending to this movie was terrible. They were going to have basically... Grant cut the cables on the T-Rex skeleton and have it crush the velociraptors.
I thought it was a pretty interesting idea that the dinosaur bones kill the dinosaur.
I think it's so much more satisfying to have that T-Rex come in and tear them things up.
Oh my gosh, of course. Yes. Oh yeah.
So that's why I picked that scene as well, even though, like I said, it's not got a lot of logic there.
And in this, Spielberg realized that. And said, no, you know, guys, even though we've spent months and months on pre-production of this, it's wrong. And the T-Rex needs to be in this. He needs to come back. We need to see him at least at the end. And he also was the one that added the whole banner falling of when dinosaurs ruled the earth. You know, which is, big marketing ploy, but it works. I think it works here. I don't think it is cheesy. I don't think it is out of place. I think it works really well.
Casting, I have a lot. Obviously, whenever these movies are big, successful movies, there is a lot of casting. So bear with me.
Sure.
First of all, I have a note that I think is hilarious that I just wanted to start with. James Cameron has said in an interview that he wanted to do this movie, and he would have cast Arnold Schwarzenegger as Grant, Bill Paxton as Malcolm, and Charlton Heston as Hammond.
And it would have sucked.
It would have been horrible.
That would have. No.
I would watch that movie in a fucking heartbeat.
No. I would let you watch it.
I would watch it for Charlton Heston more than anything. But Bill Paxton as Malcolm would be pretty entertaining, too.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
You goddamn dirty ape. Sam Neill, of course, played Grant, the paleontologist. Other people that were considered are obviously people from that time span. Dennis Quaid was considered. Kevin Costner was considered. I would have hated it if he got cast. Mel Gibson was considered, and so was Robin Williams. None of those, all of those are distinct personalities. Some lean more comic, some lean more serious. To me, what's so great about Sam Neill is he's both. He can play both very easily and seem more realistic. I don't think the closest out of those four, I would think, would maybe be Dennis Quaid.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Totally. But Spielberg's consideration, of course, was Richard Dreyfuss. And I see Richard Dreyfuss more as the Malcolm character, but I could see why he would consider Dreyfuss after doing Close Encounters and Jaws. I mean, because he's brilliant. Obviously.
Have you seen the interview where Dreyfuss talks about his reaction to Spielberg offering it to him? It's great. It's on one of the documentaries, and they interview Dreyfuss, and he goes, and Steven came to me, and he said, you know, he showed me the script and everything else, and I read it, and he called me up the next day, and he said, so do you want to do it? And I said, no. And he said, no, you don't want to do it? And he goes, Steve, I don't want to be in this movie because I want to see this movie. I want to see what you will do with this script.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And I said, that's great. Yeah. That's a great reaction.
Another person that turned down the role was Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford, to me, would be too much on that macho end of the spectrum. Like I said, it's hard for him. I mean, he can play the geekiness of like Indiana Jones. I think that's the problem. I think the character would be too similar to Indiana Jones and people would confuse them.
Agreed. Paleontologist, archaeologist. We talked about that, you know, at the beginning.
Right.
Also, you know, Sam Neill, although known at the time, was not pegged yet. You know, it's kind of like when Robin Williams first started and he was all the comedy and all the craziness and all the zaniness. Then he started being recognized because he was doing dramas. Mm-hmm. And was actually better at those. Mm-hmm. Kind of like the way I feel about Adam Sandler. I wish Sandler would stick with drama instead of trying to do comedy. But Sam Neill wasn't pegged yet. He had been in a variety of stuff and could do either or, like you said.
Well, I mean, he had always been on my radar, but it was for movies that were not big.
Right.
Yeah, because he did that Final Conflict Omen movie. He did Dead Calm, which was wonderful. I see what you mean.
But he was used to playing, I mean, in those, both of those instances, he's the villain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this one, he's the hero.
Right. Right. And he's so good in it. He's just awesome. I can't picture anybody else, but there are others. Kurt Russell turned it down.
Thank God.
Well, yeah, because then I guess it would have been big dinosaurs in little parks. I don't know.
Kurt Russell and Charlton Heston in the same movie.
They have done a movie together, haven't they?
Probably.
No, I may be thinking Escape from New York. William Hurt was offered the role of Grant, but turned it down without even reading the script or the book. So, big mistake. However, I don't know. He's a little moody. I still like Sam better. And then Dylan McDermott and Tom Sizemore screen tested for it, and neither got it, obviously. But Sizemore went on to do Saving Private Ryan with Spielberg later.
Well, Sizemore, again, probably too macho for you.
Exactly.
McDermott's not a bad choice.
No.
That's kind of interesting. He could have done pretty good.
Well, yeah, and it was long before he was as well-known as he is these days.
Yeah, so he would have fallen into that I haven't pegged you niche.
Okay, bear with me. Every woman that was acting in the year 1993 was considered for Ellie Sattler.
Okay. That's the best way of putting it. Yeah.
Nicole Kidman, Heather Graham, Lisa Rinna, Renee Zellweger, Melanie Griffith, Amanda Plummer, Kim Raver, Mariska Hargitay, Jodie Foster, Sigourney Weaver, Michelle Pfeiffer, Ally Sheedy, Gina Davis, Daryl Hannah, Jennifer Grey, Kelly McGillis, Jamie Lee Curtis, Julia Roberts, Linda Hamilton, Sarah Jessica Parker, Bridget Fonda, Joan Cusack, and Deborah Winger.
Wow.
That's a list. So they were all considered. Someone else was offered it and turned it down.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
Robin Wright.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I know. One of my favorites.
I mean, I love Laura Dern in this movie. No shade there, but I do love
Not her. At all.
Robin Wright's wonderful.
What's your favorite scene with her?
Oh, my God. There's so many. I love the look she gives Alan at the end when they're flying in the helicopter and he's got the kids in his lap.
Yeah.
I mean, that look alone, there's no words.
Yeah.
And then I love when she's coming out of that like little electronic room or whatever and just goes, run, run. She's like trying to say it and she's out of breath.
And limping.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, everything. I mean, I love My that she wants scene, to stay and help the doctor with the Triceratops and let them go on because she's examining the plant life that could have potentially poisoned it.
My favorite scene with her is the scene with the ice cream and Attenborough's character when he's slowly realizing it now and she's helping convince him.
That is good.
And it's such a... That would have been hard to me for a Deborah Winger or someone like that to play as well as Laura Dern plays it because she's got that intelligence, but also that humanity and that compassion, but the kind of sort of, don't you get it, John? This is not a good thing, what you've done kind of thing. And people are dying here.
Agreed. She was not in my list and she was probably too young, but I could see mm-hmm. someone like Sandra Bullock doing it too.
Yes, I could see mm-hmm. that. Sandra would be good. I've always liked Dern though. She's really good. You know, I'm a huge Twin Peaks fan, right. but I hated the third season thing that Lynch did, but she was probably the best part of it.
That's funny that you say that because I kept getting confused doing my research because it kept saying Laura Dern was in Twin Peaks. I'm like, she wasn't in Twin Peaks. What are they talking about? And then I realized, oh, it's the one he did last year or 3 years ago or whatever on Showtime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The third season is what they call it, which is not right. But anyway. But yeah, I think he fell in love with her during Mulholland Drive, Blue Velvet, yeah. probably. And then, you know, she's always been a huge personal friend of Lynch's.
Okay.
So they do a lot together. But she's phenomenal.
I agree. I'm not done because, like I said,
there are other humans.
Juliette Binoche was offered, but turned it down.
Yeah.
Of those women I mentioned, several screen tested, including Sandra Bullock. I guess I didn't realize that she did screen test for it. Gwyneth Paltrow, who I think would have probably been good too. Julianne Moore, Helen Hunt, Terry Hatcher, Elizabeth Hurley, and Sherilyn Fenn. yeah.
I could not see Sherilyn Fenn.
I can't either. I could definitely see Gwyneth Paltrow in there though.
Gwyneth Paltrow, I definitely could, yes.
Julianne Moore, of course, went on to play a role in Lost World, the following movie.
Yep.
And Julianne Moore is really strong, too. But here's my favorite, and this is the woman if I had to replace Laura Dern in this movie, this is who I would replace her with, Laura Linney.
Oh, yeah.
She would be perfect mm-hmm. in this movie.
Yes.
And she auditioned, as did Kristen Davis from Sex and the City. I don't see her, but I definitely see Laura Linney.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
Yeah. Jeff Goldblum played Ian Malcolm.
What a hunk.
A rock star mathematician.
One of the best, memes in the world. What are you talking about?
Well, for those of you that don't know, and you've probably already guessed this if you're familiar with the movie, the Ian Malcolm part represents Michael Crichton's viewpoint, and the John Hammond part represents Spielberg's viewpoint. If you kind of,
so to speak,
and they both acknowledge that. Other people that considered for Malcolm, though, were Cameron Thor, who ended up playing the smaller part of Lewis Dodgson, the guy that gives Nedry the Barbasol can.
Oh, okay.
Cameron Thor, that character, Lewis Dodgson, is in the new Jurassic World movies. He is the new bad guy. Because he is of the rival genetics company. However, Cameron Thor no longer plays that part because he was arrested for child pornography. Yeah. So that guy. Anyway, it was taken over by Campbell Scott, who's a much better actor anyway.
Okay.
If you watch the Jurassic World movies, I have. They're not that great.
I watched the first one and that was enough. So,
the problem with those movies is they don't get how to do an action sci-fi movie. They want to be either or, where this one is both.
Correct. Very well said.
Actually, it goes even deeper because they also want to be an espionage movie. They want to be a genetics thriller. They want to be everything. Yeah.
Well, it's a Fast and Furious kind of thing. Yeah,
it's terrible.
You know,
it's too.
We started out as street racers, and now suddenly we're a covert undercover black ops team.
Oh, and I forgot. There's a Velociraptor Whisperer in it too, because Chris Pratt plays that. I mean, there's too much going on in those movies. None of them compare to this one. Back to Ian Malcolm, another person considered for this role who I absolutely cannot stand, and it would have turned me off of this movie, is Jim Carrey.
Oh my God! Yeah. No,
can't deal. Other people considered, or actually, other people screen tested were Michael Keaton. I could kind of see that.
I could see that.
Bruce Campbell.
I could see that. Yeah.
He would have the arrogance down pat, for sure.
Yeah. And he's got enough of that snide. That's his kind of humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bruce, when you read his books or see him in interviews and stuff, he's got that kind of, you didn't think of that, did you?
No.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Right.
You know, that kind of very Malcolm-y kind of humor. Yeah. So, yeah.
Johnny Depp.
No.
I think Johnny's too small. I think you need a character to be a little bit bigger in that part, if that makes sense. I think he would have played it more like Dustin Hoffman when you need, you know, something larger.
Good comparison. Yes, I can see that.
Who else? Ted Danson.
No. No.
Steve Guttenberg.
No.
I'm going to get choked. I'm sitting there laughing so much. Michael J. Fox.
Oh, no.
I know. They're like trying to get these cute, nerdy guys. And they're not, I mean, that's what's so great about Jeff Goldblum is I don't think he's cute, but a lot of women do find him attractive, and he's great at playing a scientist. We saw it in The Fly.
Yeah. I mean, no one does eccentricity as well as Goldblum. I mean, Crispin Glover thinks he does, but he doesn't. Mm. Nobody plays, you know, nobody can do this and get away with it, you know, touch your forehead upside down with your fingers kind of thing and make it a gesture that seems normal that you do as your character.
And then,
yeah, he's brilliant.
Of those, Michael J. Fox and Johnny Depp screen tested. Oh, well, actually, it says they all did. But anyway, I have an extra note. So that's what I have for Ian Malcolm. I did go on to YouTube to see if I could find these screen tests, and I can't find them because I would love to see these screen tests.
Oh, yeah.
Richard Attenborough, who I mentioned was the Spielberg viewpoint, other people considered were Clint Eastwood.
Oh, my God.
It's terrible. And Marlon Brando.
Okay.
I can't see Spielberg putting up with Marlon's nonsense. I really.
It would have never been made.
Yeah. I mean, because he's not going to kiss Marlon's ass. Marlon would have been fired.
No. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sean Connery was offered the role based on his performance as Professor Henry Jones in the Indiana Jones movies. He turned it down.
Yeah, I could see that, though. I just, yeah, I could see that. Mm-hmm.
I would still love to see Charlton Heston play that part. Welcome to God. Jurassic Park. Okay, now we're moving on to Bob Peck, who played Muldoon, one of my favorite characters, especially in the book. He's the hunter. He's the guy they send out there to get the kids, you know, because he's good with tranquilizer guns or whatever. One person was considered for that movie that I think's perfect, and one was not. And the one I think would have been good is Bob Hoskins. He was considered. I could see that.
I could see that.
Jeffrey Jones was also considered. I can't see that at all. Cannot see that. Jeffrey Jones is from Beetlejuice.
Maybe. I mean,
the blonde-haired, mustached guy.
Yeah,
don't see it. Jeffrey Rush was considered. I don't know enough about Jeffrey Rush to know whether or not he'd be good or not.
Oh, maybe. He's got the foreign kind of feel to it. Okay. So, yeah.
And Brian, Bob Peck is British. So another person considered that I love, but I'm not sure would have been right, is Brian Cox.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And then Martin Ferrero, who I don't know, and James Woods were also considered.
Oh, yeah, no.
No, I'm sorry. I've moved on. I'm on Gennaro now. Martin Ferrero and James Wood were considered for Gennaro, and James Woods would have been perfect as Gennaro.
Remind me, which character?
Gennaro's the lawyer.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The one that ends up on the toilet abandoning the kids. Yeah. That's a James Woods role right there.
He left us. He left it.
Yeah. Ray Wise was up for the role of Gennaro.
I can see that.
Spielberg was a fan of his in Twin Peaks. Ultimately, he signed up for Rising Sun, another Crichton movie directed by Philip Kaufman, before Spielberg could get things set in stone. So he missed out by taking another film.
Good one.
B.D. Wong played Dr. Wu, who is also...
Boy, did he.
Huh?
Yes, he did. Yeah,
he's also in the Jurassic World movies. He comes back, especially in the last one.
Yeah, well, I saw him in the first one, yes.
Love B.D. Wong. No one else was considered that I know of, but when he auditioned, he actually had to use pages from the novel because the script wasn't ready. I thought that was cool.
Makes perfect sense, yep.
Tim... The little boy, played by Joseph Mazzello, was one of the ones considered for him was Jake Gyllenhaal. Little Jake Gyllenhaal.
Little Jake Gyllenhaal.
I wonder how old he was then. I guess the same age.
He was wee. Yeah. Sure.
Ariana Richards played Lex. Spielberg wanted Judith Barcy for the role. He had worked with her on The Land Before Time, but was shocked to discover she had been murdered in 1988 by her own father.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, that sucks.
Other people that auditioned were Anna Chomsky, who I could see, and Christina Ricci, who I really can't see in that role.
No.
But Claire Danes was another child actor at the time, and she was considered.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Love her.
And she would have been less annoying.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think I think actually the goal was
to be annoying,
to be somewhat annoying. Yeah, I mean, she was supposed to be the one who panics and can't take it.
Are they veggie dinosaurs?
Veggie-saurus, Lex.
This guy's in the movie, and I completely forgot that he was in the movie. Sam Jackson.
Hold on to your butts.
Sam Jackson, my man, plays with the cigarette the whole time.
Right. People don't smoke, especially in those environments. But anyway, Sam Jackson was Arnold. The other person considered, go figure. Just take a guess. This is so racist sounding.
I don't
Danny
know.
Glover. Another popular black actor at the time. It just sounds very, anyway, Sam's great in that role, by the way. And then lastly, I want to get to this. Dennis Nedry was played by Wayne Knight.
Hello, Newman.
Okay, was this before or after Seinfeld?
After.
Oh, okay. So, see, that was a risk, in my opinion.
No.
I mean, because you hate his character on Seinfeld. Is that what Spielberg's playing off of? That you want to hate him from the minute you see this guy? Or consider him annoying,
That's my guess, is that, yeah. Because, okay. I mean, hello, Newman. I mean, I can't see him without hearing Jerry say that. And, of course. But from what I understand, he didn't cast him because of Seinfeld. He cast him because of a performance in Basic Instinct in 1992.
Oh, he's the cop. Yeah.
I don't remember that movie at all.
He's one of the cops in the scene from that movie.
Yeah, that's a Paul Verhoeven movie. We've already established I'm not a fan.
Yeah, a lot of macho hanging out there with that guy. Yeah,
Spielberg saw that movie and he said he waited for the credits to roll and wrote his name down on a piece of paper.
There you go.
So he didn't know who he was. So he didn't know him from Seinfeld. But in Seinfeld, he plays a very similar character: annoying, enemy, villain. I mean, he's the same thing in Seinfeld. He is what Jerry used to refer to as Lex Luthor to Jerry Superman.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's just an evil mailman that lives down the hall. That's all he is. So, one other person was considered for that role, though. I don't think it would have worked, but Charlie Sheen.
No, it wouldn't have worked. Yeah. However, you mentioned earlier for Grant, they were talking about Tom Sizemore. He would have worked as Nedry and made him less geeky
and less overweight. More, he would have just been
more,
clumsy.
More menacing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's another reason why I love that scene, because he dies in it. So, but that's all I have for casting. I'll move on.
One thing I want to say about the cast, though, is, and it's hard for, I think, I don't want to say layman, but, just normal people who watch movies and appreciate the normal populace or whatever, especially now to appreciate with as much as things are changing on our phones and our computers and with AI and all of that. But at this time, computer graphic animation was still in its infancy and was not being used the way it could be. And it was usually very obvious that it was computer animated. And this movie revolutionized that by creating it so realistically. However, at the time it was being filmed and they were shooting these scenes, they had no concept that it would really work. They were hoping and they kind of felt good about it, but hadn't seen it. And most of these actors are performing to great big X's on the wall.
Right.
Or to Spielberg literally in a crane up above them saying, look at me, look at me, look at me. Ooh, it's wondrous. It's giant and it's incredible.
Yeah. Or he would growl. And they said that everyone used to crack up when he would try to like growl.
Oh, yeah. Because like for the Velociraptor scene, he had a bullhorn and was just making noises and stuff. So all of these actors, even the kids, being able to have this authenticity of a performance, literally looking at nothing and just imagining what it might look like, is amazing. Mm-hmm. I think is just amazing.
Oh, I just thought of another scene I like.
Yeah.
The one with the kids climbing down the electric fence and goes flying off of it.
I have that from my 10 things that could be wrong with this movie sort of list.
He would be dead.
One of those is... Well, the other one is, would he be shocked at all because he wasn't grounded? He's not touching anything. He's not touching the ground. He's literally on the fence. So he wouldn't be grounded.
Well, he probably had rubber tennis shoes on too.
Yeah. So he probably wouldn't. Plus the fact that Grant says, just jump. And he's like 20 freaking feet
love
away
that line.
From him.
I'm not going to jump. Are you crazy?
Are you crazy? Yeah.
I don't mind Tim at the movie at all. It's Lex that bothers me. Tim's actually quite enjoyable in the movie.
I actually like Tim. I like Lex by the end of it. I think she has a great fear face, which I think is another reason why Spielberg cast her. I think, to me, she works in it, just because I guess I've raised kids, so I know annoying kids, and I know the fear factor associated with all that. So, yeah.
Awards. This movie had a bunch. I just put the majors down like I usually do. For Academy Awards, it won Best Sound, Best Effects, and Best Sound Effects. So
while we're there, one of the trivias I have for this is the first movie, another first, not just CGI, but first to use completely digital sound. And Spielberg insisted on it. So if your theater was not equipped with digital sound receiving and processing and speakers, you couldn't show this movie.
Well, I would say back then, most of them weren't.
Correct. It pushed this huge industry of digital sound.
Nice.
So DTS was first seen in Jurassic Park.
Nice. I mean, that's why you should go back and see it in a theater now.
Oh, yes.
Because you will hear that T-Rex coming up behind you or whatever.
And they've planned some releases this year in IMAX and also in regular theaters for the 30th.
I think they also released it during COVID to like drive-ins. I think I read that somewhere.
Man, see, I would have loved to have seen it again and drive it. That would have been great.
BAFTAs gave it a Best Special Effects and nominated it. See, it wasn't nominated for acting in any category, just effects, but nominated it for Best Sound. However, our friends at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, otherwise known as the Saturn Awards, gave it Best Science Fiction Film, Best Director, Best Writing, Best Special Effects. And they nominated it for Actress, Supporting Actor, Supporting Actress, Performance by a Young Actor, Performance by a Younger Actor, Best Music, Best Costumes. So, the Saturn Awards were all over it. Obviously, it was a big sci-fi release. And as you mentioned earlier, it is on the 1001 movies you must see before you die.
Yes.
For those of you out there that don't know, we had a surprising number of films that we chose last year that were not, and surprising.
Yeah.
And it's nice to start our first season, our first episode of season 6 with one that is on that list. So
Definitely. I mean, I want to say...
This is my 60-second soapbox.
Before we go jump to keys and everything else, I've got in my notes about screenplay and the fact that I actually wrote down, I think Steven Spielberg is one of the best storytellers. You and I talked earlier about, you know, Cope and he working on it, but also with Crichton and everything else. The fact that we have our initial hook of 2 to 3 minutes with the Velociraptor killing the guy as he's trying to be loaded into the thing, and they actually kill it. Actually shoot her, kill that Velociraptor and everything. But then after that, we don't see another dinosaur for like 28 minutes. It's a long time till we have another action sequence. And the time they take to develop those characters and to let us see the way they interact and the way they are and all get to know them, even the lawyer and everything else before the action kicks in is so important. And I wish modern filmmakers, I'm talking to like JJs and all the rest of them, would understand that you don't have to have action piece after action piece after action piece after action piece. And even after the action starts, we still have these moments like we've talked about several seasons of this podcast where the screenplay breathes, takes time.
I think you could say the same thing about a lot of superhero movies. They know to do that. They don't have just act. They have great action set pieces, but they're spaced really well to develop
character. We need the pacing and we need the characters. We invest in characters, not in effects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we talked last season in Iron Man, you know, about that. Mm-hmm. The fact that it was such a well-done screenplay because they took the time to develop these characters and then have these incredible action pieces in between all that. And I just wish more movies did that. You know, whether it's a large-scale or a big-scale movie, it doesn't have to go... You know, we don't have to John Wick every frickin' movie and have 6 lines of dialogue and an action sequence followed by an action sequence followed by an action, you know, all the way through. So That's my soapbox for screenwriters 101 out there.
No, I totally get it. And this is actually a good segue. It's not really a segue, but a comment is the two major scenes that were excised from this film that are in the novel were included in the following movie, The Lost World, which I have not seen in a long time. And they are the Compi attack at the beginning. It's very gruesome in the book. I mean, it not only bites a girl, they're the little bitty like dinosaurs. They're like a foot high. They not only bite a girl on the beach, but they actually break into a woman's house and eat a baby.
I think they take that scene and put it in the sequel, don't they?
They may. I can't remember.
I think the Compis are either in the sequel to this or the third.
No, they're in the sequel. Yes, yes, that's what I'm saying. That scene was excised from this and put into the second movie, and so was the scene where they're going down the river and into the aviary with the pterodactyls.
With the pterodactyls. Yes. Yep. Yeah.
Because
yep.
I at the time I thought leaving the pterodactyls out was a major miss.
Agreed. I thought the same thing. I thought at least show one.
Right.
And I was talking, I was watching one documentary and they were doing like a live review of the show, of the movie as they watched it, you know, edited together, of course. But one of them was adamant that, and when they're flying away in that helicopter, they look out and they see pterodactyls.
Yes.
And the other guy was going, no, those are freaking pelicans. If you look at it, it's pelicans. Yeah. It's just birds. And the other guy goes, no, man, those are pterodactyls.
Well, no, but it is a very subtle hint on Spielberg's part that birds migrate.
Well, and also the fact that the dinosaurs were birds. Right. I mean, birds are the descendants of dinosaurs.
Exactly. So yeah, it leads, you know. To me, it's a very subtle and tasteful hook for a sequel. Trivia-wise, I read that in 2005, a paleontologist discovered red blood cells and soft tissue and fossilized bones, meaning that this could potentially one day really happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. James Cameron, I mentioned, wanted to make this movie, but the rights were bought before he could. And he said that Spielberg was the better choice, but that his version would have been much more violent. He said, think Aliens with dinosaurs. And I was like, I want to see that movie. I still want to see that movie.
No.
So, Cameron, anytime, just go ahead and do your own version. And then, all right, I already mentioned the thing about.
Well, he sort of is. I mean, all the creatures in
Avatar,
Xanadu, are, you know, Pandora.
Xanadu.
All of those creatures are kind of like dinosaurs.
Yeah, especially the Olivia Newton-John on roller skates.
Yeah, she loved dinosaurs.
All right, Keys. Oh, yeah.
Keys. Well, I've got some trivia, though.
Oh, sure. Keys, go ahead.
Just to stuff. And this is just my, like I said, my 10, these things are wrong kind of thing. Because it's amazing. I look back and it's amazing how many mistakes are made in this movie if you actually look at it closely. Some of it is frame stops that I got online that I was going, okay, yeah, but nobody watching the movie would ever notice that. But there are like four different shots that they show when you're showing, like when Tim is on the fence and he's hanging and they do that big crane shot from up above looking down and we can see Grant and Lex,
mm-hmm.
you know, way over here, right before he says jump, Tim, yeah. and everything, right? And they're far away. The fence goes like 6 feet and stops. There's no more fence on either side. It's just
that's a very fence. Movie
it
thing.
It is there. Very movie yeah. thing. You know, why would you build it and everything right. else? There's that wonderful shot when we're hearing the epic scene and the helicopter comes down. It's landing, you know, past the waterfall and everything. It looks so cool and all of that. And we see it way down there land. We see the two Jeeps parked right there beside it. Then the very next shot is on the ground as the two Jeeps back up into place. And they're just not. They're already there when you see it. Hammond is sitting on the wrong side of the helicopter. He's sitting on this side opposite Malcolm. And the helicopter is obviously going from, you know, screen left to screen right, meaning it's going to Hammond's back. So it's like if I'm sitting and I'm Hammond, the helicopter's going that way. And he looks out the window here toward the camera and goes, there it is. Well, no, it would be back there, totally opposite you. That's the only way that you would be able to see the island. But anyway, stuff like that. But we don't care. We watch it. You know, I do it just to say... even the master himself, you know, can make mistakes.
Or the average person wouldn't catch it either.
Well, the Easter egg hatching, the velociraptor egg hatching, you know, it has that funky, to show we're AI and we're modernized, you know, it has the little AI arm that picks up a mechanical arm that picks up the egg and it lays it down and it starts cracking. And then it cuts to the other shot of Grant looking at the egg and there's no hand there. It's just gone. And then it cuts back to Hammond and it's sitting there. And it's like two or three cuts of it appearing.
Continuity, spontaneity.
yeah. One that I liked when Nedry is stealing the embryos, Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus are both spelled wrong.
That's funny.
And that's one that you can actually find and see. And you go, what? Really?
I love that his desk was like a total wreck and that Sam Jackson was like ragging him about it.
Oh, yeah. And when he goes, look at this workspace.
How the fuck does he work in this? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The T-Rex, when the T-Rex first appears in one of the best sequences we both love, you know, we see his hand come up and pull on the fence.
Mm-hmm. That's in
the
book.
Then we see the fence slowly fall and we finally see him step out and everything else, you know, step over, do his roar
right.
kind of thing. A few minutes later, Grant and Tim are tipped over to the fence and it's a huge cliff that goes all the way down. Where was the Tyrannosaurus standing? It wasn't standing on that little ledge.
No, because it wasn't that ledge went down to where the trees were that the Jeep fell in. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah. Correct. I've often thought of that too.
And then my last one was I saw a thing that said that the science is actually wrong. Yes, you could see a mosquito trapped in amber and you could probably, you know, examine it or exhume it or whatever, but the blood would have degraded so far that you would not be able to get
it. I would think it would have dried anyway and desiccated somehow.
Yeah. That's the thing. Now they're actually saying that, yes, they're thinking about resurrecting mastodons, but that's actually taking the DNA from the bone marrow.
It's also they're frozen. They're up in like Antarctica or wherever. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go.
So there you go.
and the other science question that is wrong is, because I know Crichton was obsessed with the science. He wanted to at least sound plausible. Right. And that was a big deal to him because, you know, coming from his medical background and everything else, I'm sure. But why would you use frog DNA? Why wouldn't you use crocodile? And then as soon as I wrote it, I went, well, duh, because frog allows for them to breed themselves. That's kind of
the point. That's the point. David. He did that on purpose.
Right.
But also crocodiles are reptiles. And we are establishing that dinosaurs are not reptiles.
Yes, that's true. Very good point.
Because, I mean...
Look at you, Mr. Science.
Well, teacher. I mean, reptiles have to get out in the sun to regulate their body temperature. These things don't.
Yeah.
So it would have been a major... I mean, it would have bothered me had they said that.
Agreed. Yeah.
An amphibian makes more sense to me.
Yes.
So, keys.
Keys. My first key is Jaws.
Very good one.
Chrissy at the beginning swimming is just like the opening of this. You know, we have this kind of sequence where we think one thing's going to happen and suddenly it gets really horrific and then changes. But also Jaws because Brody is Dr. Grant, Quint is Muldoon, and Hooper is Malcolm.
Yes, I thought that as well. I also have a note in my keys from IMDb. That during an argument with Hammond, Nedry has a small video in the window and it's playing a scene from Jaws or something. It's his computer screen. Yeah. I didn't catch it, but I'm sure it was intentional.
Yeah, it's a little pip. It's a little window in window on his computer screen.
Mm-hmm. My big key is one I think you've already mentioned, and that's King Kong.
King Kong.
I mean, basically, he's not a dinosaur. There are dinosaurs on Kong Island or whatever, Skull Island. But there is that big gate, you know, going into the island. And the fact that they're going to an island where there is mystery and all these other creatures and stuff is very, very King Kong. So.
Oh, yeah, both of that. There's a dinosaur battle in that movie and the big gates. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got that one.
Another one I have, of course, is also Michael Crichton, and that is Westworld. Because
amusement park goes
bonkers wrong, and that's exactly what happens in this movie. To the point of, you know, people dying.
Oh yeah, that's a great one. Why didn't I think of that one? I didn't get that one, Tim. Dang you, that was good. I had Godzilla too, because Godzilla has the, you know, the whole dinosaur resurrection coming back from the past,
and he resembles a dinosaur. Yes, yeah, for sure.
I have one that you have. You might correct me on.
Okay,
but I think I'm right. The Fog. Isn't The Fog Jamie Lee's character backs up against and like a body falls out on her?
It's when her and Tom Atkins are on that boat talking, and she's leaning up against a locker, and the locker keeps jiggling, and you think he's going to, or you see the locker and you think he's going to fall out in between them, and he ends up being behind her and kind of falls over on top of her. It's a body.
That kind of, my instant, I was reminded of that when Laura Dern's character finds
the leg,
the arm. Yeah. Sam Jackson's arm, and holds it, and then it's just a
She goes, it's Sam Jackson's arm. She goes, oh, thank God, Arnold. Yeah. And then she pulls it up, and it's just his arm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then right after that is suddenly, you know, Stegosaurus or Velociraptor running.
Yeah. Poor old Sam Jackson, man. He didn't even get an on-screen death. They just kind of killed him off screen.
Man, he was good too. I love him. She goes, well, how many things are there? Oh, about 2 million.
Yeah. He's great at it. He's really good. I have Mysterious Island.
Ooh, good one. But,
the old Jules Verne story. It's actually a sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where they go to an island and there's like giant creatures on it, including bees and a weird-looking bird.
Yep.
So.
Well, you have to do all those then. You have to do the land that time forgot. You have to do the
people that time forgot.
Yep, People That Time Forgot, that whole series. All the sequels that have come from this are keys, too. Mm-hmm. You know, the sequels themselves, and then this whole reboot world dominion sort of thing that's happened.
Several. And they bring those characters back. I mean, all the original cast is in the new one. Jeff Goldblum, Laura Dern, and Sam Neill all come back in the new one.
In the newest new
Yeah.
The third movie of
Yeah, it feels like it's the end. I think it was like planned as a threequel thing, you know, spinoff.
Yeah.
It needs to be.
I have a literary reference that I got out of it too. And it's amazed me, even reading the book and then seeing this movie as many times as I've seen it, it didn't occur to me until I watched it this time. Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
The scientist who wants to create life but doesn't know the danger of what he's creating.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Michael Crichton has said this. John Hammond is basically his version of a dark Walt Disney.
Oh, yeah.
So
I could definitely see that key.
So Walt Disney in particular, as far as being the grandfather of amusement parks or what have you.
And as we said earlier, I think the key to this is literally those facilities, Disney and Universal amusement parks. Mm-hmm. And the way they're portrayed, the way they're set up, the merchandising wing, the whole ride element of it, all that, you know, smooth, we're showing them what we want them to see sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay. When we talked earlier about landmark special effects films that led to future films, we talked about how Star Wars was one. We talked about how Terminator 2 was one that led to this, that led to whatever. This movie in particular is the movie that George Lucas decided he could go ahead and start doing Star Wars movies again.
Makes sense.
And, you know, Sam Jackson actually went on to be in some of those movies. But this is the movie that made him get back on that horse in the late 90s and start doing The Force Awakens, or not, what is it called? Phantom Menace, that one.
Phantom Menace. Well, that's a good key. That's a good post key. And another one to me would be, of course, our friend James and Avatar. Mm-hmm. Because part of what they did in this pre-production for this to help with the animators was they would occasionally put people in semi-early stage motion capture. So they would put them in a studio and kind of film them. You know, they'd film Phil Tippett walking around like a velociraptor. And then they would use that to help animate the actual motions of the velociraptor. And that became eventually motion capture, which is what Cameron uses exclusively for Avatar.
I have to ask you, do you think him and Spielberg are friends?
No.
Are you saying that because you don't like him or because you have inside info?
I have seen a couple of where I got the impression they were kind of antagonistic toward each other. Cameron with his typical, I don't really care because nobody else matters to me but me kind of attitude. And Spielberg about, well, I'd rather not talk about that in an interview. I've seen a few instances
I would
of that.
Think it I would be a competition thing more than anything, but a rivalry.
I think if there's a rivalry at all, Spielberg sees it as your movies get recognized and they shouldn't kind of thing.
I mean, I just feel like Spielberg is so much more diverse. I mean, he's done so much more, whereas Cameron pretty much sticks in his little sci-fi world.
Well, and Cameron is an incredible technician. Mm-hmm. He's incredible as a technician. So I think he's great in pushing the envelope of technology, of showing filmmaking in different ways, of creating different experiences mm-hmm. for us. I just think he's a terrible storyteller.
Well, the reason I bring it up is that Spielberg has said that he studied the effects sequences, not only on Terminator 2, but also The Abyss and Young Sherlock Holmes to help him prep for this movie. So,
well, of course, Young Sherlock Holmes is the first ever computer generated character. Mm. Do you know where the first computer generated sequence was in film?
I don't think so.
Fully computer generated sequence?
I know, but
Star Trek The Wrath of Khan.
Oh, really?
We mentioned it. The Genesis effect.
Oh, yeah. Video. I could see that. Okay.
Yep. Funny. This company, this minor company said, we can make that whole thing just animated for you in the computer. Mm-hmm. And they did it. And that led to Young Sherlock Holmes, which then, of course, led to The Abyss and on and on and on. And now we are into Marvel land where we don't even know what to trust anymore. And deep fakes and all of the stuff that's happening, even on our phones and on TikTok and everything else, where we don't know what to trust anymore.
So, I have two more. One is the Jeep being chased by the T-Rex was lifted from Hatari, the John Wayne movie. And I was like, really? I went and found that on YouTube. And sure as shit, those rhinos are like trying to knock that Jeep over. I was like, damn. I mean, obviously there were no PETA rules back then because I was like, this is not good for animals. But yeah, those rhinos are literally trying to knock. They are running side by side with that Jeep and trying to knock it with their horns.
Well, I saw one documentary or something where the guy was talking about, and, you know, Timmy keeps saying, don't worry, it's a vegasaur. You know who kills more animals in Africa than anybody else? Hippos.
Yeah.
And hippos are freaking vegasauruses. Right.
They're mean. they are. I watch the Disney Channel. I know.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And then,
but I didn't know that Hatari thing. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool, and I checked it out. And then there's another movie I've never seen that Spielberg says he was inspired by called The Valley of the Guanji. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah. Valley of the Guanji. Yeah. Okay,
I don't know that movie.
Set in like the Midwest in America, and there's this valley. It's kind of like Land That Time Forgot. They end up going through this cave and crawling through and da-da-da, and they end up in this valley, and the valley has dinosaurs in it. And they end up getting out. Okay, well,
that sounds like a movie I would have loved to see. Maybe I have seen it. I don't know.
It's a very stop animation. As a matter of fact, no, I don't think Harryhausen did the animation for it, but somebody
did. Oh, and I checked. Land of the Time Forgot was not Harryhausen. It was somebody else. Some guy named Roger Dickin.
Well, and King Kong was Willis O'Brien. Okay. Willis O'Brien is the guy that
early animatronics.
Early stop animation.
Yeah. All right, is that all the keys you have?
That's it.
Well, That is
good. We made it.
We made it through our first episode of season 6. We would like to thank all of you for joining us.
Get in the helicopter.
Welcome to Jurassic Park. Welcome to our own brand of chaos. I did want to briefly let everybody know we've got a lot of cool things planned this season. We usually do 4 double features. This season we're doing 6. We're also going to revisit 4 classic season 1 episodes and redo them because we don't have them on video and we thought it was time to go back and address that. We also have 3 listener request episodes. So if you mention something to us, we pay attention. So we also have 3 listener request episodes coming up. And I happen to notice that there were at least 2 or 3 mentioned in this particular episode that we are covering this season. Did you notice that?
Could be. I did.
So, if you like what you hear, we would really appreciate it if you would give us a thumbs up, a review. Please subscribe if you're watching us on YouTube. If you really like what you hear, or if you want to know about these movies in advance, we always do a preview promo on Thursdays on YouTube and Facebook to let you know the movie that's coming up on Monday. However, if you want to know all of them in advance, you can go over to Patreon for less than a cup of coffee a month. You can get the entire list up front. We'll send it to you. And until next week, when I do believe we will be in the horror world, I guess I will be seeing you, David.
I will see you as well.
All right.
Have a good one.
Take care.